of the wagon. She might have to work the slaughterhouse yard, but not her daughter. And no one, nobody on this earth, would list her daughter's characteristics on the animal side of the paper. No, oh no. Maybe baby Suggs could worry about it, live with the likelihood of it. Sepha had refused, and refused still. This and much more Denver heard her say from her corner chair, trying to persuade Beloved, the one and only person she felt she had to convince, that what she had done was right because it came from true love. Beloved, her fat new feet propped on the seat of a chair in front of the one she sat in, her unlined hands resting on her stomach, looked at her, uncomprehending everything except that Setha was the woman who took her face away, leaving her crouching in a dark, dark place, forgetting to smile. Her father's daughter, after all, Denver decided to do the necessary. Decided to stop relying on kindness, to leave something on the stump. She would hire herself out somewhere. And although she was afraid to leave Setha and Beloved alone all day, not knowing what calamity either of them would create, she came to realize that her presence in that house had no influence on what either woman did. She kept them alive and they ignored her, growled when they chose, sulked, explained, demanded, strutted, cowered, cried, and provoked each other to the edge of violence, then over. She had begun to notice that even when Beloved was quiet, dreamy, minding her own business, Setha got her going again, whispering, muttering some justification, some bit of clarifying information to Beloved to explain what it had been like and why and how come. It was as though Setha didn't really want forgiveness given. She wanted it refused, and Beloved helped her out. Somebody had to be saved, but unless Denver got work, there would be no one to save, no one to come home to, and no Denver either. It was a new thought, having a self to look out for and preserve, and it might not have occurred to her if she hadn't met Nelson Lord leaving his grandmother's house as Denver entered it to pay a thank you for half a pie. All he did was smile and say, "Take care of yourself, Denver." But she heard it as though it were what language was made for. The last time he spoke to her, his words blocked up her ears. Now they opened her mind. Weeding the garden, pulling vegetables, cooking, washing, she plotted what to do and how. The Bodwins were most likely to help since they had done it twice. Once for baby Suggs, and once for her mother. Why not the third generation as well? She got lost so many times. In the streets of Cincinnati, it was noon before she arrived, though she started out at sunrise. The house sat back from the sidewalk, with large windows looking out on a noisy, busy street. The Negro woman who answered the front door said, "Yes? May I come in?" "What you want?" "I want to see Mr. and Mrs. Bodwin." "Miss Bodwin, they brother and sister." "Oh. What you want them for?" "I'm looking for work. I was thinking they might know of some." "You baby Suggs's kin, ain't you?" "Yes, ma'am." "Well, come on in. You letting in flies." She led Denver toward the kitchen, saying, "First thing you have to know is what door to knock on." But Denver only half heard her because she was stepping on something soft and blue. All around her was thick, soft and blue. Glass cases crammed full of glistening things, books on tables and shelves, pearl-white lamps with shiny metal bottoms, and a smell like the cologne she poured in the Emerald House, only better. "Sit down," the woman said. "You know my name?" "No, ma'am." "Janie. Janie Wagon. How do you do?" Fairly. I heard your mother took sick, that's all.
Yes, ma'am.
Who's looking after her?
I am. But I have to find work.
Janie laughed. You know what? I've been here since I was 14. And I remember like yesterday, when Baby Suggs Holy came here and sat right there where you are. White man brought her. That's how she got that house you all live in. Other things, too.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the trouble with Seth? Janie leaned against an indoor sink and folded her arms. It was a little thing to pay, but it seemed big to Denver. Nobody was going to help her unless she told it, told all of it. It was clear Janie wouldn't, and wouldn't let her see the Baldwins otherwise. So Denver told this stranger what she hadn't told Lady Jones, in return for which Janie admitted the Baldwins needed help, although they didn't know it. She was alone there, and now that her employers were getting older, she couldn't take care of them like she used to. More and more, she was required to sleep the night there. Maybe she could talk them into letting Denver do the night shift. Come right after supper, say. Maybe get the breakfast. That way, Denver could care for Setha in the day and earn a little something at night. How's that? Denver had explained the girl in her house who plagued her mother as a cousin come to visit, who got sick too and bothered them both. Janie seemed more interested in Setha's condition, and from what Denver told her, it seemed the woman had lost her mind. That wasn't the Setha she remembered. This Setha had lost her wits finally, as Janie knew she would, trying to do it all alone with her nose in the air. Denver squirmed under the criticism of her mother, shifting in the chair and keeping her eyes on the inside sink. Janie Wagon went on about pride until she got to Baby Suggs, for whom she had nothing but sweet words. I never went to those woodland services she had, but she was always nice to me, always. Never be another like her.
I miss her too, said Denver.
Bet you do. Everybody miss her. That was a good woman. Denver didn't say anything else, and Janie looked at her face for a while. Neither one of your brothers ever come back to see how you all was?
No, ma'am.
Ever hear from them?
No, ma'am, nothing.
Guess they had a rough time in that house. Tell me, this here woman in your house, the cousin, she got any lines in her hands?
No, said Denver.
Well, said Janie, I guess there's a God after all. The interview ended with Janie telling her to come back in a few days. She needed time to convince her employers what they needed, night help, because Janie's own family needed her. I don't want to quit these people, but they can't have all my days, and nights too.
What did Denver have to do at night?
Be here, in case.
In case what?
Janie shrugged. In case the house burns down.
She smiled then.
Or bad weather, slop the road so bad I can't get here early enough for 'em. Case late guests need serving or cleaning up after. Anything. Don't ask me what white folks need at night.
They used to be good white folks.
Oh, yeah, they good. Can't say they ain't good. I wouldn't trade them for another pair, tell you that. With those assurances, Denver left. But not before she had seen, sitting on a shelf by the back door, a black boy's mouth full of money. His head was thrown back farther than a head could go. His hands were shoved in his pockets, bulging like moons. Two eyes were all the face he had above the gaping red mouth. His hair was a cluster of raised, widely spaced dots made of nail heads. And he was on his knees. His mouth, wide as a cup, held the coins needed to pay for a delivery or some other small service, but could just as well have held buttons, pins, or crab apple jelly. Painted across the pedestal he knelt on were the words, "At your service." The news that Janie got hold of, she spread among the other colored women. Setha's dead daughter, the one whose throat she cut, had come back to fix her. Setha was worn down, speckled, dying, spinning, changing shapes, and generally bedeviled. That this daughter beat her, tied her to the bed, and pulled out all her hair. It took them days to get the story properly blown up and themselves agitated, and then to calm down and assess the situation. They fell into three groups, those that believed the worst, those that believed none of it, and those like Ella, who thought it through. "Ella, what's all this I'm hearing about Setha?" "Tell me it's in there with her, that's all I know." "The daughter? The killed one?" "That's what they tell me." "How they know that's her?" "It's sitting there, sleeps, eats, and raises hell, whipping Setha every day." "I'll be a baby." "No, grown, the age it would have been had it lived." "You talking about flesh, I'm talking about flesh. Whipping her? Like she was batter." "Guess she had it coming." "Nobody got that coming." "But Ella, but nothing. What's fair ain't necessarily right." "You can't just up and kill your children." "No, and the children can't just up and kill the mama." It was Ella, more than anyone, who convinced the others that rescue was in order. She was a practical woman who believed there was a root either to chew or avoid for every ailment. Cogitation, as she called it, clouded things and prevented action. Nobody loved her, and she wouldn't have liked it if they had, for she considered love a serious disability. Her puberty was spent in a house where she was shared by father and son, whom she called the lowest yet. It was the lowest yet who gave her a disgust for sex, and against whom she measured all atrocities. A killing, a kidnap, a rape, whatever, she listened and nodded. Nothing compared to the lowest yet. She understood Setha's rage in the shed 20 years ago, but not her reaction to it, which Ella thought was prideful, misdirected, and Setha herself too complicated. When she got out of jail and made no gesture toward anybody and lived as though she were alone, Ella junked her and wouldn't give her the time of day. The daughter, however, appeared to have some sense after all. At least she had stepped out the door, asked for the help she needed, and wanted work. When Ella heard 124 was occupied by something or other, beating up on Setha, it infuriated her and gave her another opportunity to measure what could very well be the devil himself against the lowest yet. There was also something very personal in her fury. Whatever Setha had done, Ella didn't like the idea of past errors taking possession of the present. Setha's crime was staggering, and her pride outstripped even that. But she could not countenance the possibility of sin moving on in the house, unleashed and sassy. Daily life took as much as she had. The future was sunset, the past something to leave behind. And if it didn't stay behind, well, you might have to stomp it out. Slave life, freed life, every day was a test and a trial. Nothing could be counted on in a world where even when you were a solution, you were a problem. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof, and nobody needed more. Nobody needed a grown-up evil sitting at the table with a grudge. As long as the ghost showed out from its ghostly place, shaking stuff, crying, smashing and such, Ella respected it. But if it took flesh and came in her world, well, the shoe was on the other foot. She didn't mind a little communication between the two worlds, but this was an invasion. "Shall we pray?" asked the women. "Uh-huh," said Ella,
first. Then we gotta get down to business.
The day Denver was to spend her first night at the Bodwins, Mr. Bodwin had some business on the edge of the city and told Janie he would pick the new girl up before supper. Denver sat on the porch steps with a bundle in her lap, her carnival dress sun-faded to a quieter rainbow. She was looking to the right, in the direction Mr. Bodwin would be coming from. She did not see the women approaching, accumulating slowly in groups of twos and threes from the left. Denver was looking to the right. She was a little anxious about whether she would prove satisfactory to the Bodwins, and uneasy, too, because she woke up crying from a dream about a running pair of shoes. The sadness of the dream she hadn't been able to shake, and the heat oppressed her as she went about the chores. Far too early, she wrapped a nightdress and hairbrush into a bundle. Nervous, she fidgeted the knot and looked to the right. Some brought what they could and what they believed would work, stuffed in apron pockets, strung around their necks, lying in the space between their breasts. Others brought Christian faith as shield and sword. Most brought a little of both. They had no idea what they would do once they got there. They just started out, walked down Bluestone Road, and came together at the agreed-upon time. The heat kept a few women who promised to go at home. Others who believed the story didn't want any part of the confrontation and wouldn't have come no matter what the weather. And there were those like Lady Jones who didn't believe the story and hated the ignorance of those who did. So 30 women made up that company and walked slowly, slowly toward 124. It was 3 in the afternoon on a Friday, so wet and hot Cincinnati's stench had traveled to the country, from the canal, from hanging meat and things rotting in jars, from small animals dead in the fields, town sewers and factories, the stench, the heat, the moisture. Trust the devil to make his presence known. Otherwise, it looked almost like a regular work day. They could have been going to do the laundry at the orphanage or the insane asylum, corn shucking at the mill, or to clean fish, rinse offal, cradle white babies, sweep stores, scrape hogskin, press lard, case-pack sausage, or hide in tavern kitchens so white people didn't have to see them handle their food. But not today. When they caught up with each other, all 30, and arrived at 124, the first thing they saw was not Denver sitting on the steps, but themselves, younger, stronger, even as little girls lying in the grass asleep. Catfish was popping grease in the pan, and they saw themselves scoop German potato salad onto the plate. Cobbler oozing purple syrup colored their teeth. They sat on the porch, ran down to the creek, teased the men, hoisted children on their hips, or, if they were the children, straddled the ankles of old men who held their little hands while giving them a horsey ride. Baby Suggs laughed and skipped among them, urging more. Mothers, dead now, moved their shoulders to mouth harps. The fence they had leaned on and climbed over was gone. The stump of the butternut had split like a fan, but there they were, young and happy, playing in Baby Sugg's yard, not feeling the envy that surfaced the next day. Denver heard mumbling and looked to the left. She stood when she saw them. They grouped, murmuring and whispering, but did not step foot in the yard. Denver waved. A few waved back, but came no closer. Denver sat back down, wondering what was going on. A woman dropped to her knees. Half of the others did likewise. Denver saw lowered heads, but could not hear the lead prayer only the earnest syllables of agreement that backed it. Yes, 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 oh yes. Hear me, hear me. Do it, Maker, do it, yes. Among those not on their knees, who stood holding 124 in a fixed glare, was Ella, trying to see through the walls, behind the door, to what was really in there. Was it true, the dead daughter come back, or a pretend? Was it whipping Setha? Ella had been beaten every way but down. She remembered the bottom teeth she had lost to the break, and the scars from the bell were thick as rope around her waist. She had delivered, but would not nurse, a hairy white thing, fathered by the lowest yet. It lived for 5 days, never making a sound. The idea of that pup coming back to whip her too set her jaw working. And then Ella hollered. Instantly, the kneelers and the standers joined her. They stopped praying and took a step back to the beginning. In the beginning, there were no words. In the beginning was the sound, and they all knew what that sound sounded like. Edward Bodwin drove a cart down Bluestone Road. It displeased him a bit because he preferred his figure astride Princess, curved over his own hands. Holding the reins made him look the age he was. But he had promised his sister a detour to pick up a new girl. He didn't have to think about the way. He was headed for the house he was born in. Perhaps it was his destination that turned his thoughts to time, the way it dripped or ran. He had not seen the house for 30 years. Not the butternut in front, the stream at the rear, nor the blockhouse in between. Not even the meadow across the road. Very few of the interior details did he remember because he was 3 years old when his family moved into town. But he did remember that the cooking was done behind the house, the well was forbidden to play near, and that women died there, his mother, grandmother, an aunt, and an older sister before he was born. The men, his father and grandfather, moved with himself and his baby sister to Court Street 67 years ago. The land, of course, 80 acres of it, on both sides of Bluestone, was the central thing. But he felt something sweeter and deeper about the house, which is why he rented it for a little something, if he could get it. But it didn't trouble him to get no rent at all, since the tenants at least kept it from the disrepair total abandonment would permit. There was a time when he buried things there, precious things he wanted to protect. As a child, every item he owned was available and accountable to his family. Privacy was an adult indulgence, but when he got to be one, he seemed not to need it. The horse trotted along, and Edward Bodwin cooled his beautiful mustache with his breath. It was generally agreed upon by the women in the society that, except for his hands, it was the most attractive feature he had. Dark, velvety, its beauty was enhanced by his strong, clean-shaven chin. But his hair was white, like his sister's, and had been since he was a young man. It made him the most visible and memorable person at every gathering, and cartoonists had fastened onto the theatricality of his white hair and big black mustache whenever they depicted local political antagonism. 20 years ago, when the society was at its height in opposing slavery, it was as though his coloring was itself the heart of the matter. The bleached nigger was what his enemies called him, and on a trip to Arkansas, some Mississippi River men, enraged by the Negro boatmen they competed with, had caught him and shoe-blackened his face and his hair. Those heady days were gone now. What remained was the sludge of ill will, dashed hopes, and difficulties beyond repair. A tranquil republic? Well, not in his lifetime. Even the weather was getting to be too much for him. He was either too hot or freezing, and this day was a blister. He pressed his hat down to keep the sun from his neck, where heat stroke was a real possibility. Such thoughts of mortality were not new to him. He was over 70 now, but they still had the power to annoy. As he drew closer to the old homestead, the place that continued to surface in his dreams, he was even more aware of the way time moved. Measured by the wars he had lived through but not fought in, against the Miami, the Spaniards, the secessionists, it was slow. But measured by the burial of his private things, it was the blink of an eye. Where exactly was the box of 10 soldiers, the watch chain with no watch? And who was he hiding them from? His father, probably, a deeply religious man who knew what God knew and told everybody what it was. Edward Bodwin thought him an odd man in so many ways, yet he had one clear directive. Human life is holy, all of it. And that, his son still believed, although he had less and less reason to. Nothing since was as stimulating as the old days of letters, petitions, meetings, debates, recruitment, quarrels, rescue, and downright sedition. Yet it had worked, more or less. And when it had not, he and his sister made themselves available to circumvent obstacles, as they had when a runaway slave woman lived in his homestead with her mother-in-law and got herself into a world of trouble. The society managed to turn infanticide and the cry of savagery around and build a further case for abolishing slavery. Good years they were, full of spit and conviction. Now, he just wanted to know where his soldiers were, and his watchless chain. That would be enough for this day of unbearable heat. Bring back the new girl, and recall exactly where his treasure lay. Then home, supper, and God willing, the sun would drop once more to give him the blessing of a good night's sleep. The road curved like an elbow, and as he approached it, he heard the singers before he saw them. When the women assembled outside 124, Setha was breaking a lump of ice into chunks. She dropped the ice pick into her apron pocket to scoop the pieces into a basin of water. When the music entered the window, she was wringing a cool cloth to put on Beloved's forehead. Beloved, sweating profusely, was sprawled on the bed in the keeping room, a salt rock in her hand. Both women heard it at the same time, and both lifted their heads. As the voices grew louder, Beloved sat up, licked the salt, and went into the bigger room. Setha and she exchanged glances and started toward the window. They saw Denver sitting on the steps, and beyond her, where the yard met the road, they saw the rapt faces of 30 neighborhood women. Some had their eyes closed, others looked at the hot, cloudless sky. Setha opened the door and reached for Beloved's hand. Together, they stood in the doorway. For Setha, it was as though the clearing had come to her, with all its heat and simmering leaves, where the voices of women searched for the right combination, the key, the code, the sound that broke the back of words, building voice upon voice until they found it. And when they did, it was a wave of sound, wide enough to sound deep water and knock the pods off chestnut trees. It broke over Setha, and she trembled like the baptized in its wash. The singing women recognized Setha at once and surprised themselves by their absence of fear when they saw what stood next to her. The devil child was clever, they thought, and beautiful. It had taken the shape of a pregnant woman, naked and smiling in the heat of the afternoon sun, thunder black and glistening. She stood on long, straight legs, her belly big and tight, vines of hair twisted all over her head. Jesus, her smile was dazzling. Setha feels her eyes burn, and it may have been to keep them clear that she looks up. The sky is blue and clear, not one touch of death in the definite green of the leaves. It is when she lowers her eyes to look again at the loving faces before her that she sees him, guiding the mare, slowing down, his black hat wide-brimmed enough to hide his face but not his purpose. He is coming into her yard, and he's coming for her best thing. She hears wings. Little hummingbirds stick needle beaks right through her headcloth, into her hair, and beat their wings. And if she thinks anything, it is, no, 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 no. She flies. The ice pick is not in her hand. It is her hand. Standing alone on the porch, Beloved is smiling. But now her hand is empty. Setha is running away from her, running. And she feels the emptiness in the hand Setha has been holding. Now she's running into the faces of the people out there, joining them and leaving Beloved behind, alone again. Then Denver running too, away from her, to the pile of people out there. They make a hill of black people falling. And above them all, rising from his place, with a whip in his hand, the man without skin, looking. He is looking at her. Bare feet and chamomile sap, took off my shoes, took off my hat. Bare feet and chamomile sap, give me back my shoes, give me back my hat. Lay my head on a potato sack, devil sneak up behind my back. Steam engine got a lonesome whine. Love that woman till you go stone blind. Stone blind, stone blind. Sweet home gal, make you lose your mind. His coming is the reverse route of his going. First the cold house, the storeroom, then the kitchen before he tackles the beds. Here, boy, feeble and shedding his coat in patches, is asleep by the pump, so Paul D. knows Beloved is truly gone. Disappeared, some say. Exploded right before their eyes. Ella is not so sure. Maybe, she says, maybe not. Could be hiding in the trees, waiting for another chance. But when Paul D. sees the ancient dog, 18 years if a day, he is certain 124 is clear of her. But he opens the door to the cold house, halfway expecting to hear her. Touch me, on the inside part, and call me my name. There is the pallet, spread with old newspapers, gnawed at the edges by mice, the lard can, the potato sacks too, but empty now. They lie on the dirt floor in heaps. In daylight, he can't imagine it in darkness, with moonlight seeping through the cracks. Nor the desire that drowned him there and forced him to struggle up, up, into that girl, like she was the clear air at the top of the sea. Coupling with her wasn't even fun. It was more like a brainless urge to stay alive. Each time she came, pulled up her skirts, a life hunger overwhelmed him, and he had no more control over it than over his lungs. And afterward, beached in gobbling air, in the midst of repulsion and personal shame, he was thankful, too, for having been escorted to some ocean-deep place he once belonged to. Sifting daylight dissolves the memory, turns it into dust motes, floating in light. Paul D. shuts the door. He looks toward the house, and surprisingly, it does not look back at him. Unloaded, 124 is just another weathered house needing repair. Quiet, just as Stampede said. Used to be voices all around that place. Quiet now, Stamp said.
I've been past it a few times and I can't hear a thing. Chastened, I reckon, 'cause Mr. Baldwin said he's selling it soon as he can. That the name of the one she tried to stab, that one? Yep. His sister says it's full of trouble. Told Janie she's gonna get rid of it. And him? Asked Paul D. Janie say he against it but won't stop it. Who they think want a house out there? Anybody got the money don't want to live out there. Beats me, Stamp answered. It'll be a spell, I guess, before it get took off his hands. He don't plan on taking her to the law? Don't seem like it. Janie say all he wants to know is who's the naked black woman standing on the porch. He was looking at her so hard, he didn't notice what Setha was up to. All he saw was some colored women fighting. He thought Setha was after one of them, Janie say. Janie tell him any different? No. She say she's so glad her boss ain't dead. If Ella hadn't clipped her, she say she would have. Scared her to death, have that woman kill her boss. She and Denver be looking for a job. Who Janie tell him the naked woman was? Told him she didn't see none. You believe they saw it? Well, they saw something. I trust Ella anyway, and she says she looked it in the eye. It was standing right next to Setha. But from the way they describe it, don't seem like it was the girl I saw in there. The girl I saw was narrow. This one was big. She say they was holding hands, and Setha looked like a little girl beside it. Little girl with an ice pick. How close she get to him? Right up on him, they say, before Denver and them grabbed her and Ella put her fist in her jaw. He got to know Setha was after him. He got to. Maybe, I don't know. If he did think it, I reckon he decided not to. That'd be just like him, too. He's somebody never turned us down, steady as a rock. I tell you something, if she had got to him, it'd be the worst thing in the world for us. You know, don't you? He's the main one kept Setha from the gallows in the first place. Yeah. Damn. That woman is crazy. Crazy. Yeah, well, ain't we all? They laughed then. A rusty chuckle at first, and then more, louder and louder, until Stamp took out his pocket handkerchief and wiped his eyes, while Paul D. pressed the heel of his hand into his own. As the scene neither one had witnessed took shape before them, its seriousness and its embarrassment made them shake with laughter. Every time a white man come to the door, she got to kill somebody. For all she know, man could be coming for the rent. Good thing they don't deliver mail out that way. Wouldn't nobody get no letter, except the postman. Be a mighty hard message, and his last. When their laughter was spent, they took deep breaths and shook their heads. And he's still gonna let Denver spend the night in his house? Ha! Oh, no. Hey, lay off Denver, Paul D. That's my heart. I'm proud of that girl. She was the first one wrestle her mother down before anybody knew what the devil was going on. She saved his life then, you could say. You could, said Stamp. Thinking suddenly of the leap, the wide swing and snatch of his arm as he rescued the little curly-headed baby from within inches of a split skull. I'm proud of her. She's turning out fine, fine. It was true. Paul D. saw her the next morning when he was on his way to work and she was leaving hers. Thinner, steady in the eyes, she looked more like Hallie than ever. She was the first to smile. Good morning, Mr. D. Well, it is now. Her smile, no longer the sneer he remembered, had welcome in it and strong traces of Setha's mouth. Paul D. touched his cap. How you getting along? Don't pay to complain. You on your way home? She said no. She had heard about an afternoon job at the shirt factory. She hoped that with her night work at the Baldwin's and another one, she could put away something
and help her mother, too. When he asked her if they treated her all right over there, she said more than all right. Miss Bodwin taught her stuff. He asked her what stuff, and she laughed and said book stuff. She says, I might go to Oberlin. She's experimenting on me. And he didn't say, watch out, watch out. Nothing in the world more dangerous than a white school teacher. Instead, he nodded and asked the question he wanted to. Your mother all right? No, said Denver. No. No, not a bit all right. You think I should stop by? Would she welcome it? I don't know, said Denver. I think I've lost my mother, Paul D. They were both silent for a moment, and then he said, that girl, you know, beloved? Yes. You think she, sure enough, your sister? Denver looked at her shoes. At times. At times I think she was more. She fiddled with her shirt waist, rubbing a spot of something. Suddenly, she leveled her eyes at his. But who would know that better than you, Paul D? I mean, you sure enough knew her. He licked his lips. Well, if you want my opinion. I don't, she said. I have my own. You grown, he said. Yes, sir. Well, good luck with the job. Thank you. And, Paul D, you don't have to stay away. But be careful how you talk to my ma'am here. Don't worry, he said. And left her then, or rather she left him, because a young man was running toward her saying, Hey, Miss Denver, wait up. She turned to him, her face looking like someone had turned up the gas jet. He left her unwillingly because he wanted to talk more, make sense out of the stories he had been hearing. White man came to take Denver to work, and Setha cut him. Baby ghost came back evil and sent Setha out to get the man who kept her from hanging. One point of agreement is, first they saw it, and then they didn't. When they got Setha down on the ground and the ice pick out of her hands and looked back to the house, it was gone. Later, a little boy put it out how he had been looking for bait back of 124 down by the stream, and saw, cutting through the woods, a naked woman with fish for hair. As a matter of fact, Paul D doesn't care how it went, or even why. He cares about how he left and why. When he looks at himself through Garner's eyes, he sees one thing. Through Sixo's another. One makes him feel righteous, one makes him feel ashamed. Like the time he worked both sides of the war, running away from the North Point Bank and Railway to join the 44th Colored Regiment in Tennessee. He thought he had made it, only to discover he had arrived at another colored regiment, forming under a commander in New Jersey. He stayed there 4 weeks. The regiment fell apart before it got started on the question of whether the soldiers should have weapons or not. Not, it was decided, and the white commander had to figure out what to command them to do instead of kill other white men. Some of the 10,000 stayed there to clean, haul, and build things. Others drifted away to another regiment. Most were abandoned, left to their own devices with bitterness for pay. He was trying to make up his mind what to do when an agent from North Point Bank caught up with him and took him back to Delaware, where he slave worked a year. Then North Point took $300 in exchange for his services in Alabama, where he worked for the rebellers, first sorting the dead and then smelting iron. When he and his group combed the battlefields, their job was to pull the Confederate wounded away from the Confederate dead. Care, they told them, take good care. Colored men and white, their faces wrapped to their eyes, picked their way through the meadows with lamps, listening in the dark for groans of life in the indifferent silence of the dead.
mostly young men, some children, and it shamed him a little to feel pity for what he imagined were the sons of the guards in Alfred, Georgia. In 5 tries, he had not had 1 permanent success. Every one of his escapes, from Sweet Home, from Brandywine, from Alfred, Georgia, from Wilmington, from North Point, had been frustrated. Alone, undisguised, with visible skin, memorable hair, and no white man to protect him, he never stayed uncaught. The longest had been when he ran with the convicts, stayed with the Cherokee, followed their advice, and lived in hiding with the Weaver woman in Wilmington, Delaware, 3 years. And in all those escapes, he could not help being astonished by the beauty of this land that was not his. He hid in its breast, fingered its earth for food, clung to its banks to lap water, and tried not to love it. On nights when the sky was personal, weak with the weight of its own stars, he made himself not love it. Its graveyards and low-lying rivers, or just a house, solitary under a chinaberry tree, maybe a mule tethered and the light hitting its hide just so. Anything could stir him, and he tried hard not to love it. After a few months on the battlefields of Alabama, he was impressed to a foundry in Selma, along with 300 captured, lent, or taken colored men. That's where the war's end found him, and leaving Alabama when he had been declared free should have been a snap. He should have been able to walk from the foundry in Selma straight to Philadelphia, taking the main roads, a train if he wanted to, or passage on a boat. But it wasn't like that. When he and 2 colored soldiers, who had been captured from the 44th he had looked for, walked from Selma to Mobile, they saw 12 dead blacks in the first 18 miles. 2 were women. 4 were little boys. He thought this for sure would be the walk of his life. The Yankees in control left the rebels out of control. They got to the outskirts of Mobile, where blacks were putting down tracks for the Union that earlier they had torn up for the rebels. One of the men with him, a private called Keene, had been with the Massachusetts 54th. He told Paul D. they had been paid less than white soldiers. It was a sore point with him that as a group, they had refused the offer Massachusetts made to make up the difference in pay. Paul D. was so impressed by the idea of being paid money to fight, he looked at the private with wonder and envy. Keene and his friend, a Sergeant Rossiter, confiscated a skiff, and the 3 of them floated in Mobile Bay. There the private hailed a Union gunboat, which took all 3 aboard. Keene and Rossiter disembarked at Memphis to look for their commanders. The captain of the gunboat let Paul D. stay aboard all the way to Wheeling, West Virginia. He made his own way to New Jersey. By the time he got to Mobile, he had seen more dead people than living ones. But when he got to Trenton, the crowds of alive people, neither hunting nor hunted, gave him a measure of free life so tasty he never forgot it. Moving down a busy street full of white people who needed no explanation for his presence. The glances he got had to do with his disgusting clothes and unforgivable hair. Still, nobody raised an alarm. Then came the miracle. Standing in a street in front of a row of brick houses, he heard a white man call him. "Say there, yo," to help unload 2 trunks from a coach cab. Afterward, the white man gave him a coin. Paul D. walked around with it for hours, not sure what it could buy, a suit, a meal, a horse, and if anybody would sell him anything. Finally, he saw a greengrocer selling vegetables from a wagon. Paul D. pointed to a bunch of turnips. The grocer handed them to him, took his one coin, and gave him several more. Stunned, he backed away. Looking around, he saw that nobody seemed interested in the mistake or him. So he walked along, happily chewing turnips. Only a few women looked vaguely repelled as they passed. His first earned purchase made him glow. Never mind the turnips were withered dry. That was when he decided that to eat, walk, and sleep anywhere was life as good as it got. And he did it for 7 years, till he found himself in southern Ohio, where an old woman and a girl he used to know had gone. Now his coming is the reverse of his going. First he stands in the back, near the cold house, amazed by the riot of late summer flowers where vegetables should be growing. Sweet William, morning glory, chrysanthemums, the odd placement of cans jammed with the rotting stems of things, the blossoms shriveled like sores. Dead ivy twines around bean poles and door handles. Faded newspaper pictures are nailed to the outhouse and on trees. A rope, too short for anything but skip jumping, lies discarded near the washtub. And jars of dead lightning bugs, like a child's house. The house of a very tall child. He walks to the front door and opens it. It is stone quiet. In the place where once a shaft of sad red light had bathed him, locking him where he stood, is nothing. A bleak and mindless nothing. More like absence. But an absence he had to get through with the same determination he had when he trusted Satha and stepped through the pulsing light. He glances quickly at the lightning-white stairs. The entire railing is wound with ribbons, bows, bouquets. Paul D. steps inside. The outdoor breeze he brings with him stirs the ribbons, carefully, not quite in a hurry, but losing no time. He climbs the luminous stairs. He enters Setha's room. She isn't there, and the bed looks so small he wonders how the two of them had lain there. It has no sheets, and because the roof windows do not open, the room is stifling. Brightly colored clothes lie on the floor. Hanging from a wall peg is the dress Beloved wore when he first saw her. A pair of ice skates nestles in a basket in the corner. He turns his eyes back to the bed and keeps looking at it. It seems to him a place he is not. With an effort that makes him sweat, he forces a picture of himself lying there, and when he sees it, it lifts his spirit. He goes to the other bedroom. Denver's is as neat as the other is messy. But still no Setha. Maybe she's gone back to work, gotten better in the days since he talked to Denver. He goes back down the stairs, leaving the image of himself firmly in place in the narrow bed. At the kitchen table, he sits down. Something is missing from 124. Something larger than the people who live there. Something more than Beloved or the red light. He can't put his finger on it, but it seems for a moment that just beyond his knowing is the glare of an outside thing that embraces while it accuses. To the right of him, where the door to the keeping room is ajar, he hears humming. Someone is humming a tune, something soft and sweet like a lullaby. Then a few words, sounds like, "Hi, Johnny. Why, Johnny?" Sweet William bend down low. Of course, he thinks, that's where she is. And she is, lying under a quilt of merry colors, her hair, like the dark, delicate roots of good plants, spreads and curves on the pillow. Her eyes, fixed on the window, are so expressionless he is not sure she will know who he is. There's too much light here in this room. Things look sold. jackweed raised up high, she sings. Lamb's wool over my shoulder, buttercup and clover fly. She's fingering a long clump of her hair. Paul D. clears his throat to interrupt her. Setha? She turns her head. Paul D. Oh, Setha. I made the ink, Paul D. He couldn't have done it if I hadn't made the ink.
What ink? Who?
He shaved.
Yeah, look bad.
No, you're looking good.
Devil's confusion. What's this I hear about you not getting out of bed?
She smiles, lets it fade, and turns her eyes back to the window.
I need to talk to you, he tells her. She doesn't answer.
I saw Denver, she tell you? She comes in the daytime, Denver. She's still with me, my Denver.
You gotta get up from here, girl. He is nervous. This reminds him of something.
I'm tired, Paul D., so tired. I have to rest a while.
Now he knows what he is reminded of, and he shouts at her, "Don't you die on me. This is Baby Suggs's bed. Is that what you're planning?"
He's so angry he could kill her. He checks himself, remembering Denver's warning, and whispers,
"What you planning, Setha?"
"Oh, I don't have no plans. No plans at all."
"Look," he says, "Denver be here in the day, I be here in the night. I'm gonna take care of you, you hear? Starting now. First off, you don't smell right. Stay there, don't move. Let me heat up some water." He stops. "Is it all right, Setha? If I heat up some water and count my feet?" she asks him. He steps closer. "Rub your feet." Setha closes her eyes and presses her lips together. She is thinking, no. This little place by a window is what I want. And rest. There's nothing to rub now and no reason to. Nothing left to bathe, assuming he even knows how. Will you do it in sections? First her face, then her hands, her thighs, her feet, her back, ending with her exhausted breasts. And if he bathes her in sections, will the parts hold? She opens her eyes, knowing the danger of looking at him. She looks at him. The peach stone skin, the crease between his ready, waiting eyes, and sees it, the thing in him, the blessedness that has made him the kind of man who can walk in a house and make the women cry. Because with him, in his presence, they could cry and tell him things they only told each other, that time didn't stay put, that she called, but Howard and Bugler walked on down the railroad track and couldn't hear her. That Amy was scared to stay with her because her feet were ugly and her back looked so bad. That her ma'am had hurt her feelings and she couldn't find her hat anywhere. And Paul D. What, baby? She left me. Oh, girl, don't cry. She was my best thing. Paul D. sits down in the rocking chair and examines the quilt, patched in carnival colors. His hands are limp between his knees. There are too many things to feel about this woman. His head hurts. Suddenly he remembers Sixo, trying to describe what he felt about the 30-mile woman. "She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order. It's good, you know, when you got a woman who is a friend of your mind." He is staring at the quilt, but he is thinking about her wrought iron back, the delicious mouth, still puffy at the corner from Ella's fist, the mean black eyes, the wet dress steaming before the fire, her tenderness about his neck jewelry, its three wands like attentive baby rattlers curving 2 feet into the air. How she never mentioned or looked at it, so he did not have to feel the shame of being collared like a beast. Only this woman, Setha, could have left him his manhood like that. He wants to put his story next to hers. "Setha," he says, "me and you, we got more yesterday than anybody. We need some kind of tomorrow." He leans over and takes her hand. With the other, he touches her face. "You your best thing, Setha. You are." His holding fingers are holding hers. "Me? Me?" There is a loneliness that can be rocked. Arms crossed, knees drawn up, holding, holding on. This motion, unlike a ship's, smooths and contains the rocker. It is an inside kind, wrapped tight like skin. Then there is a loneliness that roams. No rocking can hold it down. It is alive, on its own, a dry and spreading thing that makes the sound of one's own feet going seem to come from a far-off place. Everybody knew what she was called, but nobody anywhere knew her name. Disremembered and unaccounted for, she cannot be lost, because no one is looking for her. And even if they were, how can they call her if they don't know her name? Although she has claim, she is not claimed. In the place where long grass opens, the girl who waited to be loved and cries shame erupts into her separate parts to make it easy for the chewing laughter to swallow her all away. It was not a story to pass on. They forgot her like a bad dream. After they made up their tales, shaped and decorated them, those that saw her that day on the porch quickly and deliberately forgot her. It took longer for those who had spoken to her, lived with her, fallen in love with her, to forget, until they realized they couldn't remember or repeat a single thing she said, and began to believe that, other than what they themselves were thinking, she hadn't said anything at all. So, in the end, they forgot her too. Remembering seemed unwise. They never knew where or why she crouched, or whose was the underwater face she needed like that. Where the memory of the smile under her chin might have been and was not, a latch latched, and lichen attached its apple-green bloom to the metal. What made her think her fingernails could open locks the rain rained on? It was not a story to pass on, so they forgot her, like an unpleasant dream during a troubling sleep. Occasionally, however, the rustle of a skirt hushes when they wake, and the knuckles brushing a cheek in sleep seem to belong to the sleeper. Sometimes, the photograph of a close friend or relative looked at too long shifts, and something more familiar than the dear face itself moves there. They can touch it if they like, but don't, because they know things will never be the same if they do. This is not a story to pass on. Down by the stream, in back of 124, her footprints come and go. Come and go. They're so familiar. Should a child, an adult, place his feet in them, they will fit. Take them out, they disappear again, as though nobody ever walked there. By and by, all trace is gone, and what is forgotten is not only the footprints, but the water, too, and what it is down there. The rest is weather. not the breath of the disremembered and unaccounted for, but wind in the eaves, or spring ice thawing too quickly, just weather. Certainly no clamor for a kiss. Beloved.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.